from the Geddes Virgin and 91.1 WZBT Gettysburg. I'm Jamie Welch, and this is On Target. Today on Target, we'll provide an update on the College's Freedom of Expression Committee, as well as examine questions surrounding recent deployments of the emergency alert system.
I'm Ben Ponce. Then I'll sit down with College Republicans co-president Zach Sobeck to talk about the first 9 months of the Trump presidency after he attended President Trump's speech in Harrisburg earlier this week. Stay with us. All right, well, it's been quite a week. You can tell that it's been quite a week because I've gotten virtually nothing non-Gettysburgian related done. Too busy covering all this ridiculous news.
And so much news.
I shouldn't call it ridiculous. Some of it is quite important to the future of the college, including the Freedom of Expression Committee has begun to solicit input from the campus community on what will go in this statement that is an institutional philosophy on freedom of expression. Last week, we recorded just after Jamie returned from the faculty meeting at which this committee presented. Since then, we've published an article on our website at gettysburgian.com discussing a little bit more about that committee, and we spoke with Senator Michael Mancuso, who's the chair of the Opinions Committee, who has expressed reservations about the composition of the committee, as well as concerns that the college will seek student input only as a formality. And then we also spoke with Jennifer Bloomquist, the chair of the committee. She's the associate provost for faculty development and dean of social sciences and interdisciplinary programs. And if I got that title right on the first try, I am pretty impressed with myself. Anyway, Professor Bloomquist told us that they are adamant about getting not just Student Senate's perspective and input, but they want to really hear from a broad cross-section of the student community on campus. So I think it'll be an interesting process to watch unfold. In terms of timeline, as we mentioned last week, they're going to be soliciting input through the rest of the month. Now, in this article, Professor Bloomquist noted that they're going to aim to release a statement by the end of the semester. Previously, we'd heard by the end of November. There's not a huge difference between those two timeframes. But she was a little bit less aggressive than perhaps President Riggs. Of course, President Riggs is not on the committee, so she can wish all she wants, I suppose. But President Riggs's goal was to have a campus vote in February. And I think it's interesting to note, and Jamie, I intrigued to hear your thoughts on this. I think it's interesting to note that President Riggs said that faculty and Board of Trustees votes will be required to adopt this statement. But it doesn't sound like Student Senate or any other student organization's vote will be required to adopt it. Although in an email, President Riggs did tell me that perhaps Student Senate would like to vote, but I did not get the sense that would be a binding vote.
Yeah, I definitely am getting the sense that students, perhaps there's some merit to what Michael is saying, that, you know, the student input is merely advisory, and that the faculty and the Board of Trustees are really the ones who are getting the input here and are going to be fully listened to throughout this process.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have spoken with several members of the committee, some of whom were not quoted in this article, and all of them seem genuine in their desire to really include the opinions from across the student body. That said, I think Michael Mancuso is not alone in having concerns about just how representative a sample of opinions they will get. We'll be publishing within the next day or two an editorial that was written by Nick Arbaugh, who is the current acting president of the Young Americans for Freedom, or YAF, a conservative organization on campus, and he's also a senator. And he also, in no uncertain terms, has suggested that this committee, interesting to Arbaugh's point, is he suggests that it doesn't matter what this statement says. The mere fact that there is a statement tells you all you need to know about the possibility of freedom of expression being circumscribed at Gettysburg College and how problematic he sees that as being. I thought that was an interesting perspective.
I mean, but there is existing policy on freedom of expression here on campus. And it really seems to me that where we're going with this philosophy doesn't appear to deviate that much from what we already have as existing doctrine. I mean, our doctrine already does pull a lot from that Chicago statement, which is forming a large part of what they're saying that they like in that pros and cons sheet from last week that we discussed, that University of Chicago statement on the freedom of expression from that committee definitely seems to be what they're pulling from. So I don't know if there's going to be much change in the status quo here in regard to that. I mean, obviously, we won't know until we see the completed statement, but based on what they're saying they like and they don't like, it definitely seems to me like they're not going to be making very many edits.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I think it's important to note that current policy at Gettysburg governs only the time, manner, and place of expression and does not provide clear guidance as to content.
That's true.
There is, you know, some boilerplate language about, I mean, we quote Louis Brandeis in that famous opinion who suggests that you know, the more speech and not less is always the better option. And that certainly has been what President Riggs has said in her public communications. But it'll be interesting to see when push comes to shove what we're willing to enshrine as our institutional philosophy on this issue. This is far from the end of our discussion on that. I want to turn our attention now to a power outage that occurred on campus this week. And Jamie, it was actually interesting. You and I were standing on the porch outside a Musselman library.
We were indeed.
You were getting ready to head off campus and were dropping something off. And while we were standing there, you heard this little crack, and then you saw all the lights from across campus go out, and then a couple emergency lights a few seconds later come back on, and a whole bunch of confused students from there.
Yeah, it was certainly an interesting sight to see. There have been many power outages in my time here at Gettysburg College, but I can say that I have never been outside standing at that vantage point and witnessed every light go out. And it was almost like a wave in which they went out. It was very interesting. It was very cool to see. And then you could hear the generators fire up. It was very interesting. But students were very, very confused about what was going on, because there really wasn't any severe weather going on. They weren't sure why the power was going out, what was going on. And interestingly, we didn't really receive very much communication from our campus emergency response team. I think it was half an hour until we heard anything from them.
It was a little bit more than a half an hour until CERT, the campus emergency response team, sent out its first email at 8:30. The power went out just before 8 o'clock. I think in the past, we know the power, some lights across campus flickered earlier this year in the middle of a thunderstorm. It was not a big deal. But I think even in that situation, it was an almost instantaneous warning from CERT that the power went out. It's intriguing that it took more than 30 minutes for them to acknowledge that the power went out, particularly given that across campus there are many buildings, particularly first-year residence halls jump to mind, as well as some quarry, most residence buildings, quite frankly, that are not those motel apartments, require card access to enter the building, and in a power outage, that does not work. So either you have students who are going to be locked out, or students are going to have to be posted at the doors to let each other in, or doors could be propped open. I don't really think any of those is a scenario that the college necessarily wants.
Yeah, it's just another case. I mean, you know, because the week before we had the incident with the possibly armed person in the area. Turns out they weren't actually armed in the end, according to police. But at the time, we didn't know that. And there was mixed communications coming from the campus emergency response team. First of all, if we had a possible shooter, there was no activation of the siren. There was no text message alert sent. All that we got was an email notification that didn't even say to shelter in place. But then when we called on the phone, they said to shelter in place. So it's just interesting that these two events, 2 weeks in a row, we have sort of this lackluster emergency response or inconsistent emergency response compared to what I think would be a minimum expectation.
Yeah, particularly given that a power out, and it sounds like this power outage was caused by a simple electrical fire over at a utility pole. But I think often when the power goes out, it's due to severe weather of some kind. And I know that the library, for example, it was 8 or 9 o'clock at night. It's a time when a lot of students are in the library doing studying. The library had backup generators for about a half hour or 45 minutes, and then all students had to leave. And if they couldn't get back into their residence halls, you know, if that were a severe weather situation, would the response have been different? I don't know. But, I mean, and I don't mean to jump to a ridiculous conclusion, but it was last week around that same time that, you know, there was a possibly armed person on campus. You want to have, is it really the position of the college that students should have been wandering around in the dark alone on campus? I mean, certainly every DPS warning says not to do that. So we'll be talking. I'll be actually sitting down tomorrow with Bill Lafferty, the director of the Department of Public Safety, and Jamie Yates, the college's director of media relations, who's going to talk on behalf of CERT. We're going to dig into these issues a little bit more and see if we can clarify some of that. But certainly, I think it's worth looking into.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many questions to look into, particularly concerning why the website is hosted on our network such that if the power goes out, the website goes down and they can't disseminate information through their own website. These kinds of questions, it's just very strange. You know, if there's an emergency situation, if there's some, you know, God forbid, an attack on this campus, they may try to take out the power. And if the power goes out, then are they going to have no way to communicate with students about what's going on and what they should be doing? It's very concerning.
Yeah, clearly the Wi-Fi was knocked out in the middle of all this. The entire network was. Jamie, you have the timeline there.
Yeah,
Let's
I do.
Can you just walk through the timeline of what happened? It wasn't, I mean, ultimately, it wasn't a big deal. The power was out for maybe a little more than an hour and a half.
Yeah, so the power went out at 7:58 p.m. Then at 8:30, we get the first communication from CERT regarding the situation, came via phone and text message.
I think that first communication came through an email.
Did it? Did it come through an email?
Subsequent communication certainly came. Maybe I'm misremembering. There certainly was a preliminary communication from Paul Redfern via email.
Okay.
Paul, the executive director of communications and marketing.
Well, then at 8:50, the library closed, and at 9:15, the college issued another notice, and this one I know came via phone and text message saying that they were going to be changing the buildings over to key access so that those that are locked out and the cards aren't working will be able to get in.
So it took an hour and 15 minutes for that to happen.
Right. And then at 9:20, the college shut down the IT network completely. So any residual power was just taken away. The website was completely shut down. Wi-Fi was completely shut down. At 9:25, power was restored. So that was only 5 minutes after the network was shut down by IT. At 9:35, the main network was restored. By 10 o'clock, Wi-Fi was restored. And at 10:15, the website was restored to full service. So it took a while for the network to come back online following the outage.
Yeah. And I mean, we don't want to make too big of a deal out of a minor power outage, but certainly it seems that this exposes some larger unanswered questions, and we'll be looking into those in the coming days. One other news item I wanted to hit, and Jamie, I know you're pretty excited about this since you'll be, you know, graduating. We have a commencement speaker.
We do.
And it is Howard Fineman, the global editorial director of the Huffington Post. Howard Fineman was on campus last fall, and Jamie, you got to meet him.
I did, yeah. He participated in a roundtable discussion with various political groups on campus, and Chris Matthews was with him. So it was Howard Fineman and Chris Matthews came up here and participated in a discussion with different political groups. And as a member of the media, of the campus media, I was invited to participate in that discussion. And it was very fascinating. He's a very fascinating person. Very excited to have him come and speak at our commencement. And my understanding is that he was supposed to come last year, and then there was a little hubbub or hiccup, and he couldn't make it. So now they've sort of given him the spot again. I definitely think that he's going to have some very interesting things to say. He has a lot of experience. He's an analyst for NBC, also in addition to his work with the Huffington Post. He's appears on various shows, including Hardball and Morning Joe. And
he's also a professor at Penn.
Yep.
A lecturer at Penn. Yeah. And as you mentioned, last year he was the invited speaker for the 2017 commencement due to a scheduling conflict. He was not able to do it then. Offered to do it in 2018. The college said, sure. And sure enough, we in October know who the commencement speaker was. It's worth noting that last year, Dr. Janetta Betch Cole was announced on April the 3rd, I do believe, for
yeah.
about 1 month later.
I couldn't believe that we already had a commencement speaker. When you sent me the text message about it, I was like, what? Because I know how late it came last year. So mm-hmm. It's a fantastic choice, and I'm very excited to hear what he has to say to all of us.
And Howard Fineman was kind enough to comment
he was.
Via Twitter direct message for our article. He promised in his own tweet that he would not offer any lame advice, but then in a quote to us, he said that he would tell some jokes and offer some lame advice. So I guess you'll just have to go to the speech to see if there's truly any lame advice on the table. Jamie, somehow I think you'd be okay with some lame advice.
There's nothing wrong with lame advice in commencement speeches. I'm pretty sure that that's what they're all about, is passing on some sage wisdom and some lame advice.
Well, perhaps we'll have to title this episode Lame Advice.
That wraps up our news segment now, and now I believe we have Ben Ponce with our bullet report.
Well, it has been a bit of an abbreviated week in bullet sports action. Last weekend was reading days, but there was certainly some bullets sports action, and let's get right into it. On October the 10th, the men's golf team finished first out of 14 at the Randolph Macon Ted Keller Memorial Tournament. Then the men's soccer team on that same day defeated Susquehanna 1-0. The women's soccer team defeated Franklin and Marshall 2-1 on the 11th. The field hockey team, however, lost 2-0 to the 13th-ranked Diplomats. On October 11th as well, the volleyball team lost 3-1 to FNM. Over the weekend, the men's cross-country team finished 10th out of 25 at the Gettysburg Invitational, while the women's cross-country team finished 5th out of 31 as our own co-sports editor Elizabeth Hillfrank won her third consecutive race. The women's soccer team won 1-0 over Muhlenberg on Saturday. The women's volleyball team lost 3-0 to Muhlenberg also on Saturday, and then lost again 3-2 to Clarkson. They fell to 18-5 on the season after losing their third straight game, so they'll look to get back on track later this week. The field hockey team lost to Muhlenberg 1-0, and the men's soccer team defeated Dickinson 2-0. Thus endeth the Bullet Report.
Thanks so much for that, Ben. We'll be right back after this with Ben's interview with Zach Sobeck, president of College Republicans.
I'm joined today by Zachary Sobeck, the co-president of College Republicans here at Gettysburg and an enthusiastic supporter of President Trump. Zach, thanks so much for joining us.
Definitely. Great to be here.
So let's get right into it. On Wednesday of this week, we're recording this on Saturday, the 14th of October. On Wednesday, you traveled to Harrisburg International Airport as President Trump was interviewed there by Fox News anchor Sean Hannity, and then he gave a policy speech on economic policy focusing specifically on tax reform. What were you hoping to hear from the president, and what did you hear? What were your takeaways?
Well, as you said, it was both a taping of an episode of Hannity and a policy speech. I was not expecting that. I thought it was supposed to just be more the tax reform speech, but we got both, so that was very interesting. There were two stages set up, and we got to see both the interview, which aired that night. I think Hannity's on at 9 now, and then he went around, came up to the main stage, and gave the tax reform speech.
And what was it like? What kinds of people there? Was it truckers? I saw there was a theme of truckers. What kind of people were there? How many people? And how did you get invited to go?
Yeah, like you said, it was invite only. I believe the PAGOP, the Republican Party of Pennsylvania, were in charge of handing out tickets. Some of them went to state reps to give out to constituents, things like that. And that made it very interesting because it was almost a mixture of truckers, because truckers from various trucking organizations were invited, as well as you had some state party insiders. For example, when I was there, I got to meet with Mike Terzai, the Speaker of the House of Representatives of Pennsylvania, and Val DiGiorgio, who's the new PA GOP chairman. There were some United States congressmen who were there. They traveled with the president on Air Force One to arrive. There was Tom Marino, who's going to take a new position.
As the drug czar in the Trump administration, focusing on I believe it's the Office of National Drug Policy.
Mm-hmm. And I hope that he can do some good things there. I'm really hoping that Donald Trump can do some things in the realm of drug enforcement. And another big name there, Lou Barletta, who's running for Senate now, and will probably do very well. Then there was Lloyd Smucker, another congressman, and Mike Kelly, and Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, was also in attendance.
Mm-hmm. So one major theme of the president's speech, I think, was deregulation. He mentioned at one point that in the first 8 months of his presidency, he's undone more regulations than President Obama did in 8 years. And whether or not that's true, I think his administration has certainly been aggressive in its pursuit of policies that it suggests needlessly hamstring businesses and deregulating those policies. And just this week, Scott Pruitt, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, announced that the EPA would begin to undo the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan, which many have suggested was Obama's signature achievement on climate issues. Pruitt framed that decision as part of the Trump administration's commitment to American workers and specifically to coal miners. Do you support the decision to end the Clean Power Plan?
Well, I certainly would support deregulation in the realm insofar that people are given more economic opportunity. Donald Trump in the speech did talk about his goal of putting coal miners specifically back to work. You always have that thing, the Trump digs coal, as it were. And I do believe that it would be beneficial to remove some regulations that would allow people to find more gainful employment, help lift some of these very struggling communities out of economic despair. You see how the opioid crisis with the drugs also is affecting these people very badly. And hopefully if there was more economic opportunity in these areas, they'd be able to recover from that.
Do you see this economic opportunity, and you mentioned a lot of these communities that have been struggling in an increasingly globalizing economy, they often fall in Appalachia, which is an area certainly that the president did well in the election. Do you see, this deregulation as, you know, sort of a form of political patronage to thank those voters who voted for him, who may be more concerned about their jobs than others, who may be more concerned about climate change? I guess my question is, do you see this as a form of political patronage? And B, do you think that this needs to be a zero-sum game between economic opportunity and protecting the environment?
Well, I definitely think that if you can, you should try to target things as much as possible to try to introduce employment opportunities without damaging the environment to an unnecessary degree, if you will. But I would say certainly that the U.S. is not the world's largest polluter. And I would argue that the livelihood of these people is more important than decreasing our emissions. I don't even know how much exactly that would decrease it by, but definitely something needs to be done for the people, like you said, in Appalachia, who are largely a forgotten segment of society, who are struggling and having a very hard time. And anything we can do to help them, I think, is will be beneficial.
Do you think it's too late for the coal mining industry to come back to the United States, or do you think that it can come back? I mean, certainly in recent years, it's not just renewable energy sources, but natural gas has become increasingly a cheaper form of energy. Right here in Pennsylvania, we have a lot of fracking going on, particularly in the central and northern part of the state. Do you think the coal mining industry can come back, and do you think that's a policy goal that we should be pursuing?
It definitely could be revived to a certain degree. and revived in a way that would provide employment and, you know, you hear me talking about economic opportunity over and over again for these people. But that is a very big thing that I think especially Donald Trump should be concerned about, because he really spoke to these people when a lot of other politicians don't really talk about them, don't really go out and see them. But I'm hoping that it can be revived, and I hope that it will be revived.
And just to kind of put a cap on this theme about coal mining, do you personally believe that the climate is changing in terms of increased carbon emissions and such? And if so, do you think the government has a role in addressing that issue?
Well, you see the different graphs and the different studies that come out that show that certainly there is a degree of change in global temperatures. But I do not think that the economic prosperity of hardworking American people should be put secondary to decreasing our emissions, which in the long run, I don't even know how significant that would be to solving the global climate issue.
Speaking of that global climate issue, I want to segue to America's role on the world stage. Over the past several months, the Trump administration has announced its intention to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement, from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade deal that was in the Near East, including countries such as China, Japan, South Korea, countries in that region of the world. And just this week, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, more commonly known as UNESCO. Also, the administration has signaled reticence to continue as a member of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, and the Iran nuclear deal. Do you support each of these actions?
Well, you have the free trade agreements. They're largely different than some of the other things you mentioned. So,
well, let's look first at the free trade agreements. Let's talk about that. Do you think that America should withdraw from NAFTA? And do you support that the president withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Yes, I think that it would be more advantageous for American workers and American industry to have more bilateral trade agreements than engaging in these very large, very broad free trade agreements where other countries are able to sort of get one over on us in one way or another.
Do you have an example of that?
Sure. I think definitely if you take part in more bilateral trade agreements, you could introduce more tariffs, things of that nature, which will specifically protect American workers and American industry.
And then we said we would separate trade agreements from some of these other deals, including withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accords and UNESCO. Well, UNESCO is an organization that the United States has signaled its withdrawal from, and also potentially the Iran nuclear deal. Do you think it's advantageous to the United States to walk away from those agreements and organizations?
Well, they're all a little bit different. UNESCO was very recent, I believe. And what I had heard, I hadn't heard much about it, but what I had heard was that the U.S. was not fond of the way UNESCO was dealing with Israel and certain things regarding Israel, and that's why they pulled out.
Yeah, they signaled that because UNESCO had admitted Palestine as a full member, I believe in 2011, they have not paid dues since then. That was actually a decision under the Obama administration, and then just this week they announced that they would be withdrawing permanently. What about the Iran nuclear deal?
The Iran nuclear deal, I don't know much about the specifics of the Iran nuclear deal, but certainly President Trump has sold it as a very badly negotiated deal. And if he does think that there can be a better outcome by scrapping it and renegotiating something, he should go for it. He should try.
Do you think that backing away from international agreements, like we mentioned, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the Paris Climate Accords, is part of an America first foreign policy strategy that the president has certainly advocated, even if it creates a void of American leadership that would end up being filled by a state like China, perhaps in the case of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or India or Japan or Germany on the climate front? Do you think that it's good for America to take a step back from its role of world leadership and let these other countries potentially fill that void?
Well, I don't think that backing out of these deals in order to put forward an America First policy necessarily means that we're scaling back our leadership role in the world. If we scale back from these things and we tell other countries that we will not engage in this way that is not beneficial to our people, to our industry. And we try to do things and we increase our own prestige and power in that way. In the long run, I think it will be more beneficial. And I don't know if you really are seeing other countries filling that void. Certainly China's very economically powerful. They have been for a very long time. But I don't know if they're really filling the void of world leadership, as it were.
Well, I think particularly in the context of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, there's been a concern from many that when the United States does not have access to these emerging markets in East Asia that China now has unfettered access to through this trade deal, that could hurt American companies and could hurt American workers. Would you share that concern?
I think perhaps it might not be the best thing for big multinational companies, but I think we should be more focused on our own industries and our own American workers and try to make sure that they're getting the best out of the deals that we're engaging in.
More broadly, do you think it hurts the United States' credibility to go back on its word with such frequency on these monumental agreements? I mean, I just listed five in the beginning, and that's just from the last few months. Why should the world take America seriously when it gives its word if the next administration is just going to pull out as a matter of, you know, policy or principle?
Well, I think there's some uniqueness to the Donald Trump presidency, where you have had some people who were very similar in foreign policy, especially at the presidency, where now you do have a big pivot. I mean, he even said in his inaugural address that this inauguration, he said it was no other, because it was not merely a transfer of power from one elite of a party to an elite of a different party. It was a transfer of power from the elites to the people. And I hope that he hasn't been perfect. I would never assert perfection. But I do hope that when he does these things, he does it with the best interests of the people at heart. And for that reason, I would say it's a bit unique. And I don't think going forward you will see the same thing going on, just coming out, going back in, things like that.
But should other countries feel comfortable trusting the Trump administration's word as it looks to broker deals potentially on North Korea or on Middle East peace when, you know, a subsequent administration? I think there's been a long tradition in American foreign policy that subsequent presidents, even if they don't agree with the policies of the prior president, don't renege on the first, you know, year as a matter of principle, in the same way that the Trump administration, I think, has signaled that it's going to do. Do you think that other countries should feel comfortable taking the Trump administration's words seriously as it's negotiating these international agreements in its term?
Well, I'd be very interested to see once Trump does finally renegotiate or create a new deal with one of these countries. We haven't really seen that yet. And if they stick with it, abide by that. So I think it's yet to be seen, but I hope so.
Let's get back to tax reform,
sure,
which was the subject of the president's prepared speech on Wednesday. He said, quote, "That is why we've proposed tax cuts that are pro-growth, pro-jobs, pro-worker, pro-family, and pro-American." That's a lot of pros. "We need a tax system that is fair to working families and that encourages companies to stay in America, grow in America, spend in America, and hire in America." End quote. Do you think that's what his tax plan will do? And do you think Congress will be on board with passing it? As we know, legislative initiatives to date have struggled to find success, even as the Republicans have controlled both houses of Congress and the presidency.
Well, some of the specifics of his tax reform, he suggested the introduction of a 0% tax bracket for the lowest income families, which certainly would most likely be beneficial to those individuals. He suggested the elimination of the 10% tax bracket and a reduction of the 15% tax bracket to a 12%. I suppose the top earners, it would stay the same. So looking at those figures, it certainly seems as though this is geared towards helping the middle class, the working class, which is, I think, a very good thing. And he also talked about the elimination of the estate tax, the inheritance tax. And he framed that in the context of sometimes small businesses, when the founder of that business dies and they want to pass it on to the next generation, sometimes it's very difficult because there's a very heavy tax burden and that's going on. at the same time with changing in management, and it can be very difficult sometimes. So it seems as though it's tailored towards to be very worker friendly.
Well, let me just comment on two of those things you said. With respect to the estate tax, for 2017, the estate and gift tax exemption was $5.5 million for an individual. So an individual could leave $5.5 million to heirs and not have to pay a federal estate or gift tax. So is that really helping small business owners if you have to be making, or if you have to have more than $5.5 million to pass on? Is that really a pro-worker tax? Or does that just stratify more money in upper tax brackets, which I think is a criticism that many have levied against the Trump administration's tax plan?
Well, I do think that the inheritance tax should be eliminated. I really, this is people's legacies we're talking about. They should be able to pass that along to future generations and have, if there is a business involved, let that continue unfettered.
And, do you think the American people have the right to know how any tax plan the president proposes would affect him? And to that end, should he release his tax returns?
He can release them if he wants to. For me personally, it's not an issue.
You don't think it's important for the American people to have an idea of how a tax plan that the president proposes would affect the president?
Well, you see, during the election, he did refuse to give out his tax information, and he won, so I guess it wasn't that big of an issue.
64% of Republicans said in April that they think Trump should release his taxes, but you don't think that's an issue?
For me, no. Other people, if it's an issue for them, they should try to find out, I guess.
All right, let's turn to health care, which was another topic that's been in the news this week and that the president addressed, I know, in his interview with Sean Hannity. I don't think he mentioned it in his speech, but
he did mention his executive order in the speech.
Well, let's talk about that executive order. Just yesterday, the president announced that he would end cost-sharing subsidies under the Affordable Care Act, which, as I'm sure you know, are a critical component of the legislation. The New York Times said these subsidies, known as cost-sharing reduction payments, go to the insurance companies to offset the cost of reducing out-of-pocket expenses like deductibles and co-payments for low-income customers. Experts have said that this will make premiums spike and also cause a spike in the number of uninsured. This is not the only way the Trump administration seems to be trying to undermine or undercut the Affordable Care Act. A Politico piece published this week identified 9 ways that Trump is undercutting the healthcare system without Congress, including shortening the open enrollment period for health insurance and reducing information and advertising to encourage and help people sign up. Do you think that President Trump wants the Affordable Care Act to succeed? And do you think that it is appropriate for him to be undermining a law in a way that could directly affect or harm millions of Americans?
Well, I don't think his intention is to sabotage the Affordable Care Act by harming working Americans. I think definitely this issue would be better left up to Congress, and I think it's a real shame. You saw what happened last summer with John McCain and the big vote. I think he really let us down.
Okay, but do you think that the president wants the Affordable Care Act to succeed as it is now?
I think that he suspects that it will not succeed. And like I said, I don't think what he's doing is intentionally trying to sabotage working families.
Well, I mean, even if that's not the intent, don't you think that if fewer people can get coverage and that coverage is more expensive, that that's pretty clearly not helping some of the very people who may have been at this rally, truckers and other working class Americans in communities, particularly rural communities across the country?
Definitely, I think the executive order is lacking in certain areas, like in those that you just went over. Like I said, I think that this issue would be best solved by the Congress, and I think that hopefully in the future, maybe in 2018, you get some of these guys out. You see what Steve Bannon's doing, trying to challenge incumbent Republicans in the primaries. Maybe get some new people in there. You can do something in the future.
What do you hope to see Congress do with respect to health care in this country? Is repealing Obamacare the answer?
I think definitely repealing Obamacare. It's been a Republican goal for a very long time. They've been talking about it for since the beginning of Obamacare, and they should definitely do something to change Obamacare, maybe get rid of it, and come up with something new, hopefully that will have the best interest of the working Americans in mind.
What does that look like?
I'm not sure. I'm not going to pretend to be a big expert when it comes to the minutiae of healthcare. I don't have a lot of experience in that realm. But I'm hoping that if you do have new Republicans in office when they come in, maybe they're more civically minded. You have maybe more of that populist flair that Trump himself has. Hopefully they'll be looking out for their constituents in a better way.
Another subject that was discussed in the Hannity interview was immigration, and I know you have some strong views on that issue, as do many on campus. So let me set the stage here just where we are now. On one hand, we have the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or the DACA program, which grants a legal status to young people who came to the United States unlawfully as children. And we know this program affects about a dozen students here at Gettysburg College. And the Trump administration has signaled that it wants a legislative solution to that issue, but has drawn a line in the sand that the program will end on March 5th, 2018, without such a solution. Of course, one of the president's signature campaign proposals was construction of a border wall, and he mentioned in the Hannity interview that five prototypes have been built to date, and it's worth noting that Congress has not yet authorized construction or appropriated funds for the wall, but I think that's something that's certainly on the table at this point. And another issue that was raised in the Hannity interview was this idea known as chain migration, which is the concept that U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents can sponsor close family members to join them in the United States. Although I will say it's worth noting that this is not an immediate process and it takes a long time, which has led some experts on immigration to criticize people making this argument about chain migration for overstating its prevalence. Talk to me about how you see all these components of immigration fitting together and what type of deal or what you'd like to see happen with respect to immigration.
Well, I would really like to see, in terms of immigration, I would like to see Donald Trump come through with a lot of the promises he made during the campaign, which were so popular with his supporters. When it comes to chain migration, I think that it is important to note that if you do have people come in and illegally or otherwise, because sometimes, as you know, the people who come in illegally are given legal status and then maybe eventually citizenship or something like that. And they can bring people over, and one person turns into, 5 to 10 people, and that's not nothing. You can have a very rapidly changing demographics if that continues in a very unfettered way. And the border wall, I think, is very important, and I think a lot of people are... That's a big expectation of the administration to have that done. And have that done properly. So I think definitely he should be pursuing that. But even more important than a border wall, I think, is a visa exit system. A lot of people know that the majority of illegal aliens are not illegal border crossers, but are actually visa overstays. And there's a visa entry system where we give out visas and we know when people are coming in, and we just expect them to leave once their visa expires. And that, a lot of times, some of the time, does not happen. And we need to have a visa exit system where if someone does overstay a visa, their name goes on a list and they're deported. And I think if you had that, you would have a big decrease in illegal aliens in the country.
I do want to go back to something you said a second ago. You mentioned that people who come to this country illegally do currently have a path to citizenship. I'm not aware of any such path to citizenship.
Well, I guess I was referring more to the DACA people specifically. They don't have a path to citizenship, but sure, but they do have legal status, like you said, and they are able to... I believe that some people with legal status and not necessarily citizenship are allowed to, under family reunification, have a chain migration.
Lawful permanent residents are under that program, potentially can bring over close family members. I don't want to go back to DACA for a second. The president said...
And honestly, these people went through a lot because most of them went through our system. Many of them don't speak the language of their country because they've never been to their country. So... We are going to try and solve that. But if we're going to solve that, we want a wall and we want great border security.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems the president is pretty much admitting to using DACA recipients sort of as a political bargaining chip for some of his campaign promises, namely the wall. I mean, if you put yourself in the shoes of a student on this campus who faces an uncertain future due to DACA status, do you think it's fair for the president to be using these young people as pawns in a larger political debate, or is that what you see him doing?
Well, the whole DACA situation, I think there's a lot of non-seriousness when it comes to the discussion, where we look at these people and we say, you have been breaking the law, but because you've been breaking the law for such a long time and have become so comfortable in doing so, we'll allow you to continue doing that. I think that that is a non-serious outlook on the issue. We really should not be allowing people to just continue to break the law, because it would be very difficult to enforce. The president has an obligation to all laws.
But you don't think that someone, I mean, I think many of these DACA recipients came to the United States when they were very young, sometimes before they could even walk. So if they've never lived in another country and don't know another country and certainly didn't have any choice in coming to the United States, you still think it's fair for them to be sent back to whatever country they were born in?
Yes.
Let's turn our attention finally to a broader cultural issue. President Trump has roundly criticized National Football League, NFL players, for kneeling during the national anthem. These players have said that they are protesting police violence. And this all began, as I'm sure you know, with former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick in 2016. Do you think players have the right not to stand during the anthem?
I think they definitely should be standing during the anthem. We have seen that viewership of the NFL is down. And you also see that a lot of people are very, very unhappy with a lot of the kneeling protests. And it certainly has hurt the NFL in that way. And I don't think the players should, at their place of work, which this really is, be doing something that hurts the NFL like this. And in a broader sense, I think it's very un-American what they're doing. And you see that a lot of people are upset with that.
You don't think that these players have a constitutional right to express their opinions in this way?
I think that they do if it is, say, outside of their place of work. But when they've signed contracts with the NFL, I mean, you even know the NFL, they have very strict rules when it even comes to the uniform. You're not allowed to wear certain socks even. So I think it's kind of unique in that definitely their right to symbolic speech, things like clothing and demonstrations, are dealt with differently.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting that there's nowhere in the standard NFL contract that requires them to stand for the national anthem. I know the president had suggested that players who don't stand for the national anthem be benched or released from their teams. Is it appropriate for the president to be making those sorts of suggestions about how a private business should conduct, manage its employees?
I think so. Whether or not the owners decide to do that is up to them, but I would like to see them file the president's, not directive, but his opinion.
And more broadly, do you think it's appropriate for the president to be wading into these cultural issues, given the many urgent policy issues, many of which we've discussed today, facing the United States? I want to note that on October 7, 2013, Trump criticized then-President Obama for weighing in on the Washington Redskins team nickname. He tweeted, quote, government is shut down, yet Obama is now harassing the privately owned Redskins to change its name. He needs to focus on his job, unquote. Should the president be focusing on his job rather than football?
Well, I don't think that the time he spends sending tweets about the NFL is really detracting from his day-to-day duties as president.
All right. And last question. We are now a little over 9 months, around 9 months into the Trump presidency, and just based solely on his progress so far, I want you to give him a grade, A to F. We're not at a point, you know, we're at 9 months. How do you think he's fulfilled his campaign promises to date? I know that there's still much work to be done, but I want you to focus specifically on the first 9 months.
Okay. Well, I think you almost have two segments of his presidency so far. From Inauguration Day until about maybe a month and a half in, things were looking really great. You were having things with Carrier, you remember? He was doing trying to save some jobs there. He got out of TPP. You had the travel bans. It looked as though he was really going to come through on a lot of his campaign promises. But then you saw he faltered a little bit, and you had the Syrian airstrike, which was definitely a departure from a lot of what he said during the campaign. And now it's been little ups and downs with what he said. I think he wants to come through on his campaign promises. I think he's made some not so great appointments, people that aren't really on the MAGA train, if you will. And that coupled with his political experience, because, you know, this is his first political gig, if you will, makes it very hard for him to maneuver sometimes. So I would say he's been started off very good and has stagnated a little bit, which would maybe make me give him a B or so, maybe B minus down to the C range. But I really don't know. And I think that he has the potential to turn things around. Hopefully, if you do get a new batch of Republicans in 2018 into Congress and the Senate, you could start a turnaround pretty quickly.
All right. Zach Sobeck, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's On Target for this week. Next week on Target, we'll sit down with Janelle Wurzberger and Chris Barnes from Musselman Library to discuss Open Access Week.
We'd like to thank College Republicans co-president Zachary Sobeck for being our featured guest today. We'd also like to thank the staff of the Gettysburgian and the executive board of WZBT for their support of this project. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever else you get your podcast, as long as it's somewhere we publish.
On Target is a joint production of the Gettysburgian and WZBT. Our theme music was composed by Diego Rocha of the Class of 2019, who is a music major focusing on composition from the Sunderman Conservatory of Music.